my happy home to see what I could find out. I left my folk and friends with the aim to clear my mind out. Hit the rowdy road, many kinds I met there, many stories told me all of the way to get there. Ooh. So on and on I go, the seconds tick, the time out, there's so much left to know when I'm on the road to find out.
Welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Unspun tries to unravel the hype and illusions of corporate media through in-depth interviews with truth-tellers and advocates from around the world. Unspun is usually a call-in show, but today's show is pre-recorded. We will not be taking calls in the studio. If you would like to comment on the show, email me at unspun, that's U-N-S-P-U-N, at kkrn.org. KKRN is a community radio station and depends on listeners and underwriters like yourselves. And we need your support to bring you unique and valuable programming. So go to KKRN and click on the donate button. Our guest today is retired CIA analyst and truth teller Ray McGovern. Ray currently works with Tell the Word, a publishing arm of the Ecumenical Church of the Savior. Ray came from his native New York to Washington in the early 60s as an Army Infantry Intelligence Officer and then served as a CIA analyst from the administration of John F. Kennedy to that of George H.W. Bush. Ray's duties included chairing national intelligence estimates and preparing the president's daily brief, which he briefed one-on-one to President Ronald Reagan's and most senior national security advisors from 1981 to 1985. He is co-founder of Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, otherwise known as VIPS, exposed the way intelligence was being falsified to justify the war in Iraq in 2003. Most recently, VIPS warned Angela Merkel about the fixed intelligence or the faux intelligence around the civil war in Ukraine. Ray's writings can be found online at consortiumnews.com and antiwar.com, among other places, and also at his new website, raymcgovern.com. Ray is a truth teller that has spoken truth to power courageously and consistently for many years. Ray, welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth telling.
Thank you, Doug. Glad to be back with you.
Well, I'm glad you're back. You made a kind of a quick tour of London and Berlin and Moscow, and now you're back home. I'm glad that you're back home with us safely. Part of that trip, I saw that you were on not only Russian television, but you were also in Berlin. And did that have anything to do with the warning for Angela Merkel about what's going on in Ukraine and the whole NATO situation there?
It did, Doug. It was quite curious. It turns out that Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity, VIPS, our memo just before I left, really caught the attention of many Europeans. It got more play in Europe, certainly, than it got here. That's typical. But in this case, since we addressed it directly to the German consular in, we were written up in the most prominent German newspaper, the Süddeutsche Zeitung, and a lot of the TV interviews that I did, not only in Berlin, but also in London, focused on our warning to her, which was simply, "Hey, Mrs. Merkel, the 8 undersigned VIPs have a cumulative total of 225 years of intelligence experience, and you know we can see faux intelligence. We can recognize it when we see it." So we didn't say this in German, but the equivalent was kick the tires on that new used car there, because it is a used car, Mrs. Merkel. And besides that, you know, if you look back just 12 years, when the preparations were being made to sell the Iraq war on the basis of faux intelligence, Well, her predecessor, Gerhard Schröder, he could see that this was being used to justify a war of aggression. And the Germans, if anyone should know what a war of aggression is. And so he came out against it. And he and his French counterpart were accused of being, by Donald Rumsfeld, of all people, of being part of old Europe. You know, these old Europeans, you know, they don't like to have wars of aggression. Come on, you know, come on, get with the program. Well, they did the courageous thing and refused to join the so-called coalition of the willing. They pretty much told George W. Bush, we're not willing, okay? We know what a war of aggression is. We were instructed by the Nuremberg Tribunal, which defined a war of aggression. This, I think, is interesting, Doug. The definition that Nuremberg gave to a war of aggression was that it was the supreme international crime, differing from other war crimes only insofar as it contained the accumulated evil of the whole, end quote. Now, accumulated evil of the whole? Well, yeah. I mean, look at kidnapping. Look at torture. Look at black prisons. Look at the oppression that has come at the expense of our Bill of Rights. There's a whole lot of accumulated evil here, not only in our country, but in Europe as well, Britain especially. And so we wanted Merkel to think about all these things. And indeed, I think she played, perhaps not as a result of our memo, although we are sure she got it, she seemed to play a constructive role at the NATO summit in Wales. You know, that summit was the most important NATO summit in many, many decades, really. And it had to do with whether we ostracize the Russians, whether we give arms to Ukraine, whether we invite Ukraine into NATO. All those things came up, and there was no discussion of bringing Ukraine into NATO, although that had been decided 6 years ago at the Bucharest summit in 2008. And there was no discussion, really, of giving arms aid to Ukraine. They ducked that by doing this quick reaction force where they're going to emplace logistics and other materiel in forward bases closer to Russia so that they can rotate troops there on a rotation basis and avoid violating the promise made to the Russians not to station permanent troops there. So they're not going to be permanent troops. They're just going to be kind of unpermanent troops. They're going to be rotated in. It's sort of like those, you know, remember the permanent military bases that we coveted in Iraq? And they decided, well, that sounds a little too imperial, so we won't call them, permanent, we'll call them enduring military bases.
That's the adjective. Yeah, enduring.
Yeah. Reminds me, Doug, of that, pity me if all those enduring young military, endearing young charms was the word. So maybe they thought that enduring sounded a little bit more endearing. And that's the moniker they gave us. Well, similarly here, we're not going to have permanent group stations, but they'll be rotating. There is more substance to that one because permanent troops would be a direct violation of the accords achieved with Russia, NATO and Russia, prohibiting that kind of stationing of permanent troops.
And let me play a little clip from Anders Rasmussen, who is the NATO Secretary General, and he was interviewed right after that that NATO summit, if you can call it that. It was really just, 7 or 8 leaders sitting around together with their State Department and military counterparts. But let me play this because I think it's really interesting what he says, and he's trying to defend the very policy that you're talking about. I think they call those spearhead troops or something like that. And but let me play this clip because I think it's interesting.
NATO certainly then has a lot on its plate. NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen joining me now from Newport in Wales to discuss the alliance's priorities at this week's summit. And ahead of this summit, you have already announced the creation of this rapid response force, sir. You said that NATO cannot afford to be naive, but can it afford to be provocative? Because that is exactly how Russia reads that announcement.
It's not provocative to defend our allies. We take purely defensive measures in accordance with our international commitments, and we have an obligation to ensure effective defense and protection of our allies.
It's pretty provocative to have announced just in the past hour or so that you'll be conducting multi-nation exercises. I know these have happened before in Western Ukraine, but given the circumstances, I put it to you again, your actions appear to be pretty provocative.
It's not provocative to defend our allies. And it's not provocative to develop a partnership with countries in Europe, including Ukraine. We do have a partnership with Ukraine, and we adhere to the principle that each and every nation has the right to decide its security policy, including its alliance affiliation itself.
It almost sounds like he was there with the jets taking off behind him. I'm not sure where he was, but I thought that was interesting wording. It kind of reminded me of George Tenet when he was saying, we do not torture. We do not torture. And it's not provocative.
No, it's not provocative. Anders Fogh Rasmussen has a very sad history. Spearhead, I think, is the wrong expression here for this new quick rapid response team. It's more like a conehead, you know. Rasmussen has a history of deceit and a history of being a puppet of the United States. He got great favor with the Danes for having a close relationship with George W. Bush, who invited him to Crawford. You know, he was wined and dined at Crawford. And then when George W. Bush came to Europe, he stopped and saw Anders Fogh Rasmussen in his little castle. So what did that do? Well, the Danes just loved the notion that the U.S. and Denmark are very close to each other. The Germans had a Germans had a film one time, and the word was, "So geht es mit den Dänen und Dänen, die den Dänen nachstehen." And it means that's the way it is with the Danes and all the people who are kind of near to the Danes and the way they look at things. Shakespeare said it even better. There's something rotten in Denmark. and there is indeed. Now, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, on the 19th of March 2003, one day before U.S. and U.K. attacked Iran in what can only be described as a war of aggression, Rasmussen got up before his parliament in Denmark. He was then the prime minister, and he said, and I quote, "It is not that we believe there are weapons of mass destruction there. We know it." Period. End quote. Now, where do you suppose he got that from?
Well, Rumsfeld was pretty sure it was around Tikrit somewhere, right?
Right. Well, you know, the deal is this. You know, you could almost argue that people like Rasmussen were deceived by the United States. But one of our veteran intelligence professionals for sanity, a major in Dutch Army intelligence, his name is Frank Graviel, he was so appalled at what Rasmussen said and did that he released to the Danish press the briefing documents the Danish intelligence had given Rasmussen, and those documents said, don't be deceived by the United States. There aren't any. There is no evidence of weapons of mass destruction. There's going to be a war here, and we're all going to pay the price. Now, what happened to Frank Greenfield? Well, until John Kiriakou, Frank Greenfield was the only veteran intelligence professional's facility to be put in prison, a dark, dank Danish prison. Now, it was only for 3 months, but my God, you know, he had a 19-year-old daughter, nobody to look after her, his wife was deceased. And so that's what happened to that whistleblower, Frank Greenfield, of whom we are very, very proud. He saw the situation, he needed to release the documents to show that Rasmussen was lying, and yet Rasmussen escaped any opprobrium because the Danes, because Bush, you know, visited him. The Danes are really strange in that respect, and it kind of smells, as Shakespeare said. So, more recently, what's Rasmussen doing? Well, he's still speaking from the Washington script. How did he get to be Secretary General of NATO? Well, guess what, Doug? We have WikiLeaks cables that show that it was the U.S. that put him in there. Now, people might not be so surprised by that. Everyone knows that the U.S. has inordinate influence in NATO. But here are the documents to prove it. The Turks were kind of a stumbling block. And they wanted something to... they wanted a price. They wanted something to get for endorsing Rasmussen. And so these U.S. cables, these State Department cables, show that Rasmussen did the necessary to betray the Kurds. The Kurds are everyone's favorite to betray. He betrayed them in a very essential manner. The Turks were very pleased, and the Turks says, oh, he's got our vote. So Rasmussen, Secretary General of NATO, a fellow named Amano, Japanese diplomat, who is the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the one that inspects nuclear sites like the ones in Iran. We know about him from WikiLeaks as well, because the deputy chief of mission, our mission in Vienna, reported back to Washington saying, ah, Amano, he's all set to take over the leadership from the dastardly fellow El Baradei, who wouldn't say there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And so, Amano's all ready, and he's very, very thankful for all our support, and he welcomes the notion that he will talk to the Israelis offline, and he'll do pretty much what we tell him to do. He does need a little more money, though. He wants to fix up his office a little bit there, so... now, that's in the State Department cable. Now, who signed the cable? Jeffrey Pyatt. Who's Jeffrey Pyatt? He's now the ambassador to Ukraine.
He's so a neocon, these people, right? Is he one of the neocons?
Well, yeah. He gives cookies to the proto-fascists there on the Maidan. So this is all, I guess my point in relating some of this is that it's incredibly corrupt, and it shows the hands of the United States in a documentary way that one could kind of assume is the case. But here are WikiLeaks cables, thanks to Bradley, now Chelsea Manning, and thanks to Julian Assange, who now sits in his own little dungeon there in the Ecuadorian embassy in London for over 2 years now, because he had the guts to go ahead and make these things available to the world. So just to finish up on this folk Rasmussen, he's not to be taken seriously. He still reads from the U.S. script, and of course he was one of the fellows that was responsible for those wonderful, wonderful photographs of Russian invasion in eastern Ukraine, which actually showed nothing at all. It was an embarrassment to any professional intelligence officer. Those photos were, if those photos were the best that they could serve up to prove, in quotes, that the Russians had invaded southeastern Ukraine, well, I just have to say that I'm from Missouri. Are there Russians in southeastern Ukraine? Of course there are, you know. Are there tanks rolling in or self-propelled artillery? Well, I'd like to see better photographs, better intercepted messages, better resolution to the images. And failing that, I would have to say, what really happened here, and this is important, what really happened here is 4 weeks ago, everyone was saying, the Ukrainian army is making great strides. It's pretty much a mop-up campaign now against those, quote, pro-Russian separatists, end quote. Now, I use the quotes advisedly because, you know, you can use words to give a very misleading, self-serving impression. They are not pro-Russian separatists. They are anti-coup federalists. Now, there's a big difference. It's not that they're pro-Russian that they're doing this thing. It's because their duly constituted elected president, Yanukovych, was deposed in a Western, a U.S., EU-led coup on the 22nd of February this year. And the first thing they did was to say, well, you know, let's say that Russian is no longer an official language. Let's kick the Russians out of Crimea. There were all kinds of crazy people saying crazy things. Now, Russian escaped is still the one of the official languages. But if you're a Russian watching all this, or even if you're just a Russian heritage person out there in the southeastern Ukraine, and you see not only that the coup was mounted, supported by the United States, which immediately recognized the putsch government, but you see who's leading these things. Proto-fascists, the right sector, Svoboda. I mean, the UN has recognized the leaders of these factions as Nazis, pretty much. And they're leading the charge, and they're leading the Ukrainian army in the east. Getting back to the situation on the ground, which is, as usual, all important, after all the Western journalists were taking their material from the authorities in Kiev, the Ukrainian government, all of a sudden it became clear that the Ukrainian army was not winning. And indeed, the Ukrainian soldiers were writing back home and saying, this is awful. These colonels, these light colonels, these majors, they don't know what they're doing. They owe their jobs to these oligarchs. And we're getting beat bad. And, you know, I'm coming home. I don't know how I'm going to get home, but there were desertions by the hundreds. They were leaving ammunition behind. We see boxes of rockets there that they're opened and not used. So they were running away, and a lot of them were encircled. Now, how did that happen? That happened because Ukrainian forces are indeed poorly led. They're poorly trained. And, you know, it's kind of hard to get cousins to shoot at their cousins, okay? That's just the way it always is. We're talking about human beings. So, on the other side, the anti-coup or anti-putsch federalists, the people, when I say federalists, I mean somebody who wants a little autonomy for their region. They don't want to separate from Ukraine, and the Russians wouldn't have them. That's made clear on both sides. They want to stay in the Ukraine. They just want to have some regional autonomy, and that's why I call them anti-putsch federalists. Anyhow, they started winning big time, okay? Now, the Ukrainians had to find some way to explain this very quick reversal, and guess what? The solution offered itself real easy, Doug. The Russians are coming. The Russians have come. The Russians have sent their tanks in. The Russians have invaded Ukraine and turned the tide of the battle against the Ukrainian government. Well, the tide of the battle had been turned against the Ukrainian government. Did the Russians help? Sure, I'm sure they have some special forces in there helping out. But was there a Russian invasion? Tanks and self-propelled artillery, as claimed by Anders Fogh Rasmussen and his people there in the Netherlands. No way was it that. Otherwise, they would have shown us better evidence than they have. And that's why we wrote to Merkel, because we wanted her to know, you know, this evidence really stinks. And you ought to Ask your own intelligence people whether it stands up to close scrutiny, bearing in mind that your own intelligence people are really just a kind of a satellite of U.S. intelligence and are willing to say whatever they think the U.S. intelligence wants them to say. That may be a little overstated, but we wonder about that. And as I say, the way the thing came out in Wales was better than I feared. This rapid reinforcement thing was a cosmetic thing. It will bother the Russians, but not as much as if they started giving arms to the Ukrainian, or if they repeated their pledge to incorporate Ukraine in NATO.
So let me remind the listeners, you're listening to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. With us today is Ray McGovern, retired CIA analyst, truth-teller, and peace activist. We're discussing faux intelligence and the aggressive NATO-U.S. propaganda effort regarding Russia and Putin. And Ray McGovern is going to be here in Reading, both the September 15th and 16th, that's next week, and he will be first at Simpson University on Monday night on the 15th at 6:30 at the Labam Rudat Lecture Hall, and then on the night, Tuesday night, the night of the 16th, Ray will be speaking at 7 p.m. in room 802 at Shasta College, and both of these are free events. The title of his talk at Shasta College is going to be "Are Freedom and Security Compatible?" And the talk at Simpson University is "The Constitution and the Constant Surveillance State, Are They Compatible?" Very similar titles, a little bit different, one relating more to our constitutional rights than the other, but the public is invited to all of these events, both of these events, and this is a kickoff of Ray's North State tour. And so we're so glad to have you come to the North State, Ray, and share your information.
Yeah, let's finish up on Ukraine, and then yeah, we'll talk yeah, a little yeah. bit about these other subjects.
Well, let me ask you a question leading into that.
Sure.
It looks mm-hmm. like the neocons have their nose in everything. And I remember, I think there was either Robert Scheer or somebody interviewed one of the neocons during, I think it was like 2005, and then he said, well, you fact-based people, while you're busy analyzing and catching up, we're moving on to the next thing. And that's almost what this whole thing looks like, starting out in Syria, and then Russia got involved there and defused that situation, and so then they went and started this Ukrainian, the whole thing with the Russian and Putin demonization. And then now that doesn't look like it's working real well for them, especially with the sanctions that are backfiring on many of the European nations. And now we have ISIL and the Islamic State in Levant, and it looks like that's going to lead us right back to Syria.
Yeah, well, Doug, it's really important that people understand the stakes involved in Ukraine. And it's really, it's been my experience that people are malnourished on the fare that they get from the so-called mainstream media. I was in Moscow recently, up early at 6 o'clock. BBC wanted to hear from me about Ukraine and all kinds of things, and the first question they did was they played a little clip of Secretary of Defense saying, Putin grabbed Crimea, and this is the first instance of overt land grab aggression since World War II, and so we have to measure up to that. And said, no, Mr. McGovern, what do you think of that? And I said, well, that's sort of coming in the third act, I mean, certainly Secretary Hagel knows, I hope he knows, that there is not one scintilla of evidence that Vladimir Putin or any of his co-leaders had the foggiest notion of reincorporating Crimea into Russia proper before the coup in Kiev, when a Western-installed regime came in and started making all threats to to kick Russians out of Crimea, among other things. So you know, you really shouldn't start the story with Crimea. It starts with the putsch. It starts with the Assistant Secretary of State, Victoria Nuland, saying to Jeffrey Pyatt, the U.S. ambassador in Kiev, Yats is our guy. The other guys can put a weight in the wings. Yats is our guy. He knows. He's been head of the central bank. He knows about the austerity measures that the IMF will require. He's our guy, Yats. Now, that was intercepted by whom? I suppose by the Russians. But I don't know. Anyhow, it winds up on YouTube at the end of January. We're talking this year, right? It's up there on YouTube, and it's the original transcription. Nuland says some profane things about the EU in the same conversation, which I can't repeat on air, but anyone can fish that out. Now, there it was, the U.S. plotting to remove the duly constituted, duly elected person, Yanukovych, and put in Yats. Now, 3 weeks later, on the 22nd of February, I wake up in the morning, come down, open my little computer there, and the first thing I'm saying is, yikes, it's Yats! Yatsenyuk. I guess Victoria Nuland has a little trouble pronouncing the word. Yatsenyuk was pronounced the interim prime minister of Ukraine. Now, why do I mention that? Besides the title I gave to the piece I wrote that day, yikes, it's Yats. I mention it because, you know, our Declaration of Independence has this wonderful phrase, paying attention or having a decent respect for the opinions of mankind. Well, in the old days, if you're going to do a little coup or a putsch or whatever, you know, Yats would have been disqualified by having appeared in YouTube 3 weeks before as the Washington's guy, you know. But no. There's not even any reluctance or any embarrassment. Yats was that guy, and Yats is still the prime minister. So that was where it all started this round. Of course, earlier on, as I mentioned before, 6 years previous, NATO in its wisdom, after having been warned, and we know this warning from the WikiLeaks cable, and this is worth just a brief mention, Sergei Lavrov, who was then in 2008 and is now the foreign minister for Russia, he called our ambassador in. It was Bill Burns. Now, Bill Burns is the deputy secretary of state, so he moved up, but he was ambassador of Moscow then. So Lavrov says, look, Bill, Mr. Ambassador, Nyet means Nyet. We hear rumors that you're trying to incorporate Ukraine in NATO. That's one incorporation too far. This will lead to civil strife in Ukraine, perhaps civil war, and we will have to face the unpalatable choice as to whether or not to intervene. So don't do it. Realize that Nyet means Nyet. Now, here's the cable. We have it. I've seen 5,000 cables from Moscow in my career, but this is the real deal, and it's titled by Ambassador Burns, Nyet means Nyet. Lavrov draws Russia's red line against NATO membership for Ukraine. Well, that was the 1st of February 2008. On the 3rd of April, so 2 months and 2 days later, NATO, in its wisdom, issued a formal declaration saying Ukraine and Georgia will become members of NATO, quote, end quote. So, talk about not taking Russian warnings seriously. Well, that was the case. And we can talk about how the head of Georgia tried to give the Russians a bloody nose just a couple months later and got his rear end whacked. And now the Ukraine has come to the fore with the putsch and with the investment of $5 billion, according to Victoria Nuland, the Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, $5 billion with a B has been invested in what she calls Ukraine's aspirations to join the West. Well, There you have it. $5 billion. You could do a lot of stuff with $5 billion. So that's at the core of this thing. I'm glad that that Putin and the Ukrainian Poroshenko, Ukrainian president now, have agreed to a ceasefire. I haven't checked today, but last time I checked, it was holding. And this looks like a promising resolution might be possible, so long as Washington doesn't goad on Yatsenyuk to think that he would profit more from resuming hostilities, and so long as Yatsenyuk himself is able to control the pro-fascists that have been let loose now in South and Southeastern Ukraine, and so long as Putin can control the anti-coup Federalists, who could easily be provoked by the Nazis that I just mentioned. So it's pretty delicate still, but we have the main players, Putin and Poroshenko, trying to enforce this thing. And if Obama doesn't have the sense to back the ceasefire, then I fear for what's going to happen, because this time it's not some sideshow. This time it's a confrontation between the United States and Russia, both of whom are nuclear powers. And let's hope that common sense prevails, and that Obama can rein in his neocons and do what he did this time last year: say no to a widened war. They had him 10 hours or 20 hours, actually, away from giving the okay to strike Syria. And he said, no, that's not what I'm going to do. I'm going to Congress for authorization, because I know that's required. Let's just hope that in the current complex of issues, and I'm talking now more about Syria and Iraq, that Obama will remember what he learned in law school, hopefully, and realize that he has to go to Congress to get permission to bomb Syria. And bombing is not going to solve any problems.
Well, I believe that he said in his speech that he didn't need that authorization. The same authorization that allowed him to go into Somalia was the one that he quoted as being his authority, whatever that was. And so that's another question. And coming back around, I want to ask you about your travels. We still have quite a bit of time. We've got about another 20 minutes in the show. I'd like to ask you a couple of things. Maybe we can leave ISIL for another time, because I know that you had mentioned, and I know that you've been in close contact with two whistleblowers. Well, actually, one whistleblower and one journalist, WikiLeaks, considering WikiLeaks a news outlet, Julian Assange. And you had mentioned that you had a chance to visit with both of them on your trip. Maybe you could tell us about that. That's pretty exciting news.
Yes, I did. I always try when I'm in London to visit with Julian Assange. There is a courageous person who has been persecuted for simply getting the word out or facilitating people like Bradley Manning, now facing 35 years actually, in a military prison. Actually not facing, he's there. Julian Assange, in contrast, is not in prison, literally, but he's cooped up in the Ecuadorian embassy. He hasn't seen the sun in many, well, I guess he can see it out the window sometimes, but not very often in London. He's able to function. WikiLeaks is still putting out very, very interesting and important and embarrassing things. But the thing we talked mostly about during a long dinner and nice conversation just a week ago now, that was this. Very few people know how Ed Snowden was able to escape from Hong Kong and get to what turned out, ironically, to be the safest place for him in the world, Moscow. Can you imagine? I mean, the mind, you have to turn your mind around. Anyhow, what happened was this. When Ed revealed all his documents and gave them to Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras, you know, they're journalists. They're not social workers. And so they said, thanks a lot, Ed. You'll understand. We got to go home now and write our stories. Put yourself in Ed Snowden's place. There he is, alone in Hong Kong. The authorities are closing in on him because he made no bones about where he was. And so what happens? Well, this is important. He was saved by Julian Assange. Julian had all manner of contacts and people, most important, really able people, to put on this problem. And Sarah Harrison, one of his chief lieutenants, happened to be in Australia. He said, Sarah, get yourself to Hong Kong as soon as you can. Get this guy out of Hong Kong on his way to Cuba, where a couple of the Latin American countries had offered him asylum. Well, there's a film coming out next month in October, and it's going to be terrific. It will show exactly how they did it, because Laura Poitras filmed it, filmed the whole thing. There were hundreds of journalists around. You can imagine how many CIA guys, and they did it. They got on that plane and took off for Moscow. Now, en route Moscow, Secretary Kerry thought it would be a good idea if he pulled Snowden's passport. And so he did, rendering Ed Snowden stateless. And so, to their great credit, WikiLeaks asked Sarah Harrison to stay with Ed Snowden in Sheremetyevo Airport for 5 weeks. And finally, long story short, Vladimir Putin granted him asylum. Now, one point I'd like to make about that that hasn't been made by anybody else, maybe it's because I'm an intelligence officer, okay? Now, intelligence officers, the last thing they want to do is to condone giving away the family jewels, right? I mean, you don't want to be in a position of saying, wow, this guy gave away the American family jewels, so I want to give him asylum. You know, think about how Putin must have looked at that, saying, you know, if I give this guy asylum and tacitly, implicitly condone what he did, what's going to happen to the next KGB guy or the KGB successor people who want to do the same thing? You know, they're going to figure, well, it must be all right. So my point is that he did it in spite of that concern. And I think he did it partly because he gets so missed at John Kerry getting up with his pastel tie on and saying, Mr. Putin, you must give Edward Snowden over to us. I know there's no extradition treaty between our two countries, but you must give him over because we want to prosecute him, blah, 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 blah. And the secretary, the attorney general says we will not torture him and we will not kill him by, you know, executing him. So give him over. I can see Putin sitting around the table with his associates, you know, saying, who is this guy? Who is this guy? You must. Come on. And I, you know, in a kind of human sort of way, if Putin needed more incentive to defy the United States on this thing and give Ed Snowden asylum, which is now renewed for 3 more years, Kerry is a master diplomat in saying stupid things, and I think Putin just said, you know, let's welcome him now. Now Ed is free. He's free to do what he wants. Sarah Harrison stayed with him for the first several months just so she could attest to the fact that he wasn't being, well, how shall I say, that enhanced interrogation techniques were not being applied to him, you know, and that he wasn't spying for the Russians and all that kind of thing. So, and that she went home, and now he's able to get out and about. He met me, and quite out in the open, and he's still able to do a lot of good work in terms of telling congressmen and Bundestag abgeordneten what's going on and how they might be able to protect the world from the kind of intrusive surveillance which makes no one free. So Julian was just fun to be with. He likes visitors, and I'm honored that he and I have had dinner more than a couple times together. And as far as Ed was concerned, it's just 2 days ago, we had lunch together and a nice conversation. He was really tired. He operates on Eastern Daylight Time. Can you imagine? Because that's when all the emails, traffic goes and all that kind of stuff. So here we were, middle of the day, Moscow time. So he looked a little tired and confessed to being tired. So we only spent about 3 hours together and went back to my hotel. But he's well. And the thing that I'm trying to register here is that when I was with Julian, I said, Julian, you know, very few people know that it was you and your lieutenants that are responsible for Ed being in the most safe place for him on the face of the earth. And if I remember correctly, Julian, he didn't give you one piece of paper, right? He didn't give you one report for WikiLeaks. And Julian said, "That's right. Yeah, it was the principle of the thing. We just needed. We were required to do everything we could to make sure that other potential whistleblowers could know that it's possible to remain safe, it's possible to remain alive, it's possible to remain out of prison and still do your constitutional duty to reveal gross violations, in this case of the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, which requires a warrant and probable cause before you snoop on American citizens." So I said, "Well, you know, it worked out pretty well for Ed, didn't it?" And Julian smiled a broad smile and said, "Yeah, we're committed to this kind of thing. And Ed knows how this worked, how this went down. Sarah Harrison, she's endangered in going home to the UK. And so her lawyers said, you better not go home." So she lives in Berlin right now, and I had a wonderful lunch with her, too. So it was an incredible trip for me, meeting these old friends and people that I admire so much because of the guts that they have displayed.
Yeah, it adds a whole different dimension to what's been going on with the NSA and free speech here in America. Let me remind our listeners one more time. You're listening to a pre-recorded pre-recorded show, broadcast of Unspun and Experiment in Truth, telling I'm your host, Doug Bennett. With me today is Ray McGovern. Ray is a retired CIA analyst, truth teller, and peace activist. We're discussing faux intelligence, aggressive U.S.-NATO propaganda, and the whistleblowers that Ray contacted, and he'll be talking more about them on his tour here of the North State.
Doug, let me make a suggestion here, since we're on, 9/12, and yesterday was 9/11.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And since we're going to be talking about this kind of surveillance and what NSA has been doing, what's important to know about 9/11 is that NSA had information that apparently they kept to themselves that would have certainly prevented 9/11. Now, we veteran intelligence professionals for sanity put out a memorandum on the 6th or the 7th, I forget which, of January this year, which was titled NSA Whistleblowers Explain What Happened, okay, or something like that. You can go to warisacrime.org/VIPS. and see the whole list of the 32 corporate memos that VIPS has put out. In any case, we decided that it would be really good if these four NSA whistleblowers, Tom Drake, Bill Binney, Kirk Wiebe, and Ed Loomis, if someone forced them to write up experience. And so we, VIPS, cajoled them into doing it. They gave me a kind of contributions, and I put the thing together. It's a long memo, but we got Tom Drake to pronounce on something he was sort of saving for his book, and it was that he was given the job. He stayed on after 9/11. Matter of fact, 9/11 was his first day on the job, although he had scads of experience with NSA before then. But he was a senior executive hired under a special program, and they thought he was like all the others. And so Tom said, Tom, no, look, the Senate is really hot on us. They want to know what we knew between 9/11. Why don't you investigate? So Tom did. And you know what he found out? He found out that NSA had written a major memorandum identifying all the nodes and all the places where NSA, where Al-Qaeda was operating. And get this, NSA had not only the telephone number of the Al-Qaeda safe house / switchboard in Yemen, they had the telephone numbers of the two hijackers of the plane that went into the Pentagon in San Diego, okay? Did they have the conversations? How many were there? Well, let me just tell you what the President of the United States said about 5 months ago. He got up and he said, oh, this dragnet surveillance program, if we only had it in place before 9/11, we might have been able to find out the telephone numbers of those hijackers in San Diego and that one message that they sent to the switchboard place there in Yemen. The president was either misled or he was lying. We had the numbers. We had the conversations, not just the metadata. We had the content of the conversations. The conversations would certainly have prevented 9/11. According to Tom Drake, NSA kept it to themselves. They never disseminated it outside. So the president is not telling the truth when he says, oh, if we only had those numbers and we might have gotten it from this dragnet surveillance. Well, they've gotten nothing from dragnet surveillance. And guess what? We had the numbers, Mr. President. We had the numbers. You know what? It's as easy as caller ID. Bill Binney, who knows more about an NSA collection, is the one that explains that. It's not hard to explain. Once you get one number, you get the others. And we had those numbers, and yet nothing was done. Tom thinks it was because knowledge is power. NSA was very jealously safeguarding, for whatever reason, this knowledge and did not release it to the rest of the intelligence community, to the FBI, to the CIA, anybody else before 9/11. So that makes three. That makes NSA. It makes the FBI, which had Moussaoui up there in Minnesota and wouldn't give permission to look into his laptop. He was one of the potential hijackers. And, of course, the CIA knew about these two Al-Qaeda types in San Diego, but never told the FBI about it. So, you know, you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist, Doug, to think that this stuff smells awful. And I still don't know what happened, how 9/11 went down. But what I do know is that it was a terrible travesty on intelligence analysis.
We had William Binney and Thomas Drake both on our show. Thanks to you, actually. You gave me the contact information on them. And recently, William Binney has come out and is supporting reopening the investigation of the 9/11 conspiracy. We can call it a conspiracy, sure. Right? Because the government is calling it a conspiracy. Only the government's accounts don't seem to account for everything. And But he's come out just recently, I think it was 2 weeks ago, asking for a new investigation. And I think that's gaining a lot. The public is mm-hmm. becoming more and more aware of that and understanding mm-hmm. that we didn't really get the whole story.
Yeah. Well, I, too, have come out for that many years ago, actually, and particularly when the two co-authors or the two co-chairmen of the 9/11 Commission, Governor Kaine from New Jersey and Lee Hamilton, who is the ostensible Democrat that they always trot out to chair one of these commissions, they wrote a book, Doug. The book was written 4 years ago, and the book says, quote, "We, the 9/11 Commission, was set up to fail. We were not given enough time. We were not given enough money. We were not given enough access to classified materials. We were set up to fail, period," end quote. Wow. Well, that's just great, you know? I mean, it would have been nice if they told us at the time, huh? So, when people say the 9/11 Commission report was a cover-up, well, it was. It had to be, because they were not given all these things necessary to make a decent report. Are there good? Is there some good stuff in the 9/11? Sure there is, but the whole thing can be described as the government's account, or if you want, conspiracy, to hide what really happened. So we don't know what happened. Do I know what happened? No. Do I respect some of the people who are looking into it? I detest them being called conspiracy theorists. They're just trying to find out what the heck went down here and how it went down. And that's not fair to call them conspiracy theorists. No.
And there were also, I think, Tom Drake testified in front of that commission, and his testimony was left out of the report entirely. And he was supporting what you said, that we already had the information about the terrorists, the hijackers.
That's right. And that shows the degree of corruption within our government, not only the executive, but the Congress as well. They don't want to hear about it. They don't want to deal with it. And Binney and Loomis and Wiebe and Tom Drake all went to the proper channels to get the proper people cognizant of what happened, and they were rebuffed. Worse than that, they were raided by the FBI. Bill Binney was in the shower, and they came in with guns drawn, and their houses were ransacked, and you know, all this stuff taken away. And Tom Drake, and maybe, you know, this is kind of something kind of neat to know. Easy for me to say. Tom Drake was subjected to 4 years of persecution/prosecution by 9 top-level attorneys from the so-called Department of Justice, end quote. Now, did any good come out of that? Well, it's hard to think that any could. But you know what? I saw it in Moscow when we walked into that room. Tom, Jesselyn Radick, Colleen Rowley, and I. Ed Snowden looked right past all of us, looked right at Tom Drake. And I could see what he was thinking. He was thinking, my God, here is Tom Drake, who suffered those 4 years of persecution, just so I could learn how to do this without getting wrapped up. I had to leave Dodge, you know, get out of Dodge. I had to go east. That's the only way it would be safe. But Tom Drake, his example, what he went through, is why I'm here now, free, you know, pretty free, at least not free to go home, but free. And Tom Drake, looking at him, and I could tell, I verified this with Tom. I said, Tom, I bet I know what you're thinking. You were saying, wow, 4 years of torture, and I never thought anything good could come out of it, but this is good. This is really good.
Well, Ray, we are out of time. It has been a pleasure having you on Unspun and Experiment in Truth Telling, and I'm looking forward to seeing you next week at both Simpson University and Shasta College. Get a chance to see you share some more of your information about the surveillance state.
Looking forward to seeing you. Bye now.
Bye-bye. You've been listening to Unspun and Experiment in Truth Telling on KKRN Community Radio at 88.5 FM in Bella Vista. Our special guest today has been Ray McGovern, retired CIA analyst, courageous truth teller, and founder of Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. His website is raymcgovern.com. This show and links to his website will be on kkrn.org. In the Unspun Archives, Ray McGovern will be in Reading as part of his North State Lecture Tour. Starting Monday evening, he will be at Simpson University in the Labam Rudat Lecture Hall at 6:30 p.m. He will be at Shasta College on Tuesday evening, that's the 16th, at 7 p.m. in room 802. Both lectures are free and open to the public.